2005. We will not be hearing House Bill 2985 today, but there's a series of meetings going on. We want to give them time to present the bill to us in a proper form, so we'll open a work session on House Bill 2704. And committee, this does have a referral to the Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. We have dash two amendments, and Representative Greenlick is here to talk about his dash two. Good afternoon, Representative.
Has that subsequent referral not been deleted? I did have a discussion, as you remember, at your request with the Speaker's office, and
to my knowledge, it has not.
I wonder whether it
would you like to delay?
Yeah, I expect there's no problem with, since both you and the committee chair on agriculture and natural resources have suggested it didn't need to go there, and I did get a request in the Speaker's office, and it didn't sound like it was going to be a problem, so I wonder whether it wouldn't be best to delay it until we... Patty, do you have a comment?
I don't think it matters if we move it. I think you wanted to explain the dash two amendments, I think is why you had the representative here. But
we could just move the bill to the floor.
Yes.
That's your wish.
Not to the floor.
I mean to the ag committee. Yeah. But what representative is saying, I think, is that you don't want it to go to ag.
Well, I mean, it seems it just adds a bit of confusion if the Speaker has no problem with it not going to ag. But
I haven't talked to her, so I can't tell.
None of us have heard anything that would take that referral off. So it's up to you, Representative. If you would like us to delay this until you can clear this up, we'll be happy to do that for you.
Should we delay it till, is there time to delay it till sometime Wednesday?
Sure.
I mean, there's still time on the notice.
If you want to make a notice that you'd carry this over to the Wednesday meeting, we can move and put that in.
All right.
Let's do that, and then we'll see if we can clarify. If not, we can move it.
Okay, we'll carry it over to Wednesday's meeting. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2704. And open a work session on House Bill 3312. Committee, this is a gut and stuff. So we have an entirely new bill before us, and as a result of that, we have a lot of testimony that I think the committee needs to hear, because we have virtually an entirely new bill, which is also has been amended. So I'm going to... I've got a long list of people who would like to speak, but I'm going to ask Lana Butterfield to come forward first. Sam, can you read what the... we can read what the bill was originally about.
Well, the bill was originally about pertaining to permitting process and to allow cities or counties to be able to contract with other entities as far as permitting. The dash, committee, I'll draw your attention to the dash two amendments. You have a dash one and dash two. The amendment, the dash two, will replace the original provisions of the bill, and it will amend ORS 197.772, and that is a section that deals in part with historic properties, and specifically properties which are designated, have received historic designation, and to allow property owners to be able to opt out of that designation. In 1995, the legislature had amended some provisions within that to be able to allow property owners to opt out of certain regulations. This amendment would seek to be able to allow people to opt out of, there was some confusion whether it was limited to state, local, and not federal. My understanding is the amendment would pertain to any of the three jurisdictions. The drafters have indicated that that would not relieve anybody of any building permits that they may need within that particular local jurisdiction, or my understanding is it would not relieve any, if there was a local land use regulations that would need any kind of permitting, if this would not. It was just a historic designation that it's, I believe, affected by.
Ms. Butterfield, do you
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and with me is Al Johnson. I'd like to actually have him present the bill because he is the attorney that has been working for the client that we represent, Jim and Ginevra Ralph, who are property owners in Eugene.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Al Johnson. I'm an attorney in private practice concentrated in land use, and I'm here today on behalf of my clients, James and Ginevra Ralph. They have joined with other neighbors in their neighborhood in South Eugene in a coalition called the South Eugene Property Owners Coalition. And it's on their behalf that this bill has been generated in response to a rather surprising sort of resurrection of what we thought was a moribund effort to create a special historic district in South Eugene. This has a long history. The Ralphs live in an area where the National Historic District, about 10 net blocks, was proposed in 1981, but it failed because the majority of the property owners objected, and under the federal act, that means that the district cannot be created. The converse of that is that under the federal act, if a district is created and fewer than a majority object, then the district takes effect, and there is no opt-out from the designation. And we're not challenging that or asking to have that change in any way. What's happened to occasion this is that since 1981, the proposed district has now ballooned to all the parts of about 28 blocks, a much larger area. It's been returned to a federal keeper of historic places because been returned once by the federal keeper because of procedural and vote counting issues. And it is now back at the State Office of Historic Preservation pending resubmission to the federal keeper. The aggressive expansion of the district has diluted the opposition vote and watered down the quality of the proposal district. The federal standards, unfortunately, federal standards for designation are very lightly interpreted. There are almost no instances that I've been able to find of designations actually being turned down once they get to the federal level. So that almost any neighborhood is above average these days, and we expect a federal listing would happen. And that's in the cards and going to be changed by what we're asking you to do today. The problem is that this bill is not about the National Register listing. It's about the regulatory consequences of that listing. In 1995, the legislature adopted a bill which became ORS 11-7772, which gives property owners the rights to opt out of historic property designations, districts, and regulations at state and local levels. The original intent was to have that apply at the federal level as well. However, the committees and the legislature got word from the state office and from the Attorney General's office here that it would create problems to allow an opt-out from the designation process. So that was changed. However, what has happened since then is that has turned into a device to get around the entire opt-out purpose of that 1995 legislation. By tying local regulations to the federal listing process, this allows people to opt out of individual National Register listings, but not out of National Register Historic District designations. So what happens is that when you get one of these mandatory federal districts created and you're dragged into one of these districts, the local government has regulations in place that are tied to that federal designation. And the effect of it is not only to get around the opt-out provisions of ORS 11-7772, but it happens in such an automatic way by definitions in local codes that these designations take place without the local jurisdiction having to give any attention to whether or not adding this area of town giving it this overlay and creating a special set of safeguards and compatibility requirements affects any other goals. As will be the case, whenever you apply a local zoning district in Oregon, you have to look at whether or not, if we're going to upzone this area, does that mean that we're going to violate our affordable housing obligations under statewide housing goals and housing statutes. Which means we're going to be pushing burdens out of our neighborhood and onto other parts of the neighborhood, or putting or preventing infill that creates pressure on urban growth boundaries. All that is bypassed by the subject approval process. HB 3312-2 would address this problem in a very simple way. It would simply delete the federal designations and local regulations. This is consistent with the current intent of the 1995 legislature. It's consistent with federal law. It eliminates a lot of problems. It would allow property owners to decline to consent to special local permitting standards and procedures that are triggered by federal determinations of eligibility for listing on the National Register of Historic Places. And I want to emphasize the National Act doesn't require state or local governments to regulate those properties. It would not, however, allow anyone to opt out of general local building permit requirements, general local land use requirements, anything that the rest of your neighbors have to do with their properties by way of building permits, you would still have to do. And if you didn't opt out during the designation process, you wouldn't be able to opt out later. And if you didn't opt out, you would not, if you did opt out, you would not be eligible, of course, for the various incentives. So it means that the incentives become more focused. So it's a very, very limited kind of fix. Now, the packet that I've given you includes correspondence from the National Keeper and correspondence from the State Historic Preservation Officer, correspondence from the Attorney General's office in 1995, pointing out what the problem was that they saw with the 1995 legislation giving a general opt-out to federal designations. Those problems did not have to do with some federal requirement that state or local governments impose land use regulations or special permitting requirements. Those problems had to do with the fact that state and local historic preservation officials need to be able to identify and submit potential properties for listing. They need to participate in the designation process, and they need to participate in the process which leads to a determination of eligibility, which is the next step before that. Very clear, and I quoted that language in the AG's opinion in my letter. It says there are two problems. One is the problem of listing for historic districts, which is not entirely voluntary. The other is that the determination of eligibility is not entirely voluntary. Nothing about, and that's all about the processing. That's not about the local regulations. There's a table here that might be helpful to you that's in the packet that basically describes the difference between the designation process, the regulation process, how that was treated under the previous bill, and how it would be treated under the current bill. And again, the only change that would happen here would be that there would be the ability to opt out of local historic preservation regulations regardless of the designation that they were based on. It does not change the ability of the state and the local government to comply with federal requirements that they process and list historic properties. It does not change that balance of power. We feel that this delinking is actually very, very healthy for historic preservation. I'm sure you'll hear some people disagreeing with that today, but there is a problem of unintended consequences, and especially a problem is created when something is susceptible to manipulation, or there are sort of fringe benefits to a designation. They have nothing to do with historic properties, but have to do with having your neighborhood perhaps treated a little more special than other people's neighborhoods. Delinking will be consistent with the federal policy, which is incentives, not coercion. it will result in, I think, less opposition to nominations because the consequences will be eligibility for incentives, not susceptibility to having your neighbors decide whether or not your house remodel is consistent with the dominant design in your neighborhood. There will be less use of the listing process to secure preferential land use treatment within urban areas. There will be less pressure on other areas within those very scarce urban lands to accept infill and affordable housing and other uses that excluded or restricted historic districts. There will be less use of the listing process to impose architectural tiers of neighborhood majorities on neighborhood minorities. That's probably good for neighborhood harmony, I would suspect. There will be less dilution of federal designation standards because if the real goal is to designate things because they're worthy, you're going to get things that are worthy. We have a real problem here of just about any neighborhood that wants one now can go out and get handed a good housekeeping seal of approval, and that's a kind of grade inflation. It's not healthy for the program, and that actually results in a dilution of the kinds of public cost expenditures that are spent in administering these programs, in giving the incentives, and making a program work that has a set of benefits but is fairly costly to administer. So it has a lot of upside, very little downside. I think you will find that my clients, for example, are happy to be voluntarily in the historic preservation activities. They've bought and preserved the Baptist Church in downtown Eugene, which is now the Shed, which is the center of the Oregon Festival of American Music, which they founded and are running. They're very, very interested in historic preservation. They are responsible public citizens who want to do their part, but they would like to be able to do their part on a voluntary basis. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Johnson? I think I'd like to have you remain in the area as we go through some folks and hear some of their objections so that you will have an opportunity to respond to those questions.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there a representative from the city of Eugene here? Yeah. Could you come up, please? I know you and I have spoken off the record in regard to the city's position on this, but for the benefit of the entire committee, we'd like to hear your comments about this bill as it is in the Dash 2 amendments, with the Dash 2s.
Thank you, Chair Gerard. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Huser, Intergovernmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene. I'd like to preface that I'm basically a layperson about this issue. I do want to try to answer whatever questions I can, but I think I'll go ahead and leave some of those questions to be answered later on by some of the other people on the panel. I think I want to start off by saying that the role of cities on the front end about how these get created is one matter. What goes on afterwards, after there is a listing, and how we try to regulate some level of preserving historic character of neighborhoods, that's a different issue. On the front end, the city of Eugene was contacted probably at least three or four different times over the last 15 years as folks have considered pursuing a listing. And in that capacity, the city of Eugene plays a role in sort of advising them about the process, helping them go towards steps to get the sort of listing. It's an advisory type capacity, and it's something, a very reasonable request that we comply with. It does not mean that we try to infuse any support or opposed position of a listing. We do our best just to advise folks about how the process works for them and how they can go through it. You all are probably getting some things passed out to you right now, and there's a couple of materials there. One, there's a map of the proposed area for the listing as it is pending today. The other thing that you'll probably see is a letter from Mayor Kenny Piercy, and that I believe that letter was sent in January. Let's see. Oh, I'm sorry, March. Although that would have culminated after a meeting that occurred February 9th, and you have the minutes to that meeting. Mayor Piercy being new on the job, wisely did not want to move too quickly to send any sort of a letter to the SHPO or to the federal government without fully considering all the facts and hearing from both sides of the story, the proponents and the opponents of the listing. And you can see in the listings, she asked for two representatives from CPAC, and also that's the Property Owners Association, I believe, and then two representatives from SUNA, which is the Neighborhood Association itself. Additionally, city attorney was there, and planning director, and officials from the SHPO. And after that meeting was over, I think one of the things that Mayor Kenny Kersey listened to very carefully was she wanted to know whether or not the proponents had complied with everything that was required of them for the application. And after she learned that the answer was yes, after some deliberation, she later decided to send a letter to the SHPO, which I believe, although it is certainly considered during the process for a listing, it is not an up or down dependent upon whether or not the mayor of a city sends a letter. It was simply something that she was asked to do, and after she had learned that all of the criteria had been met, she went ahead and sent the letter. So to the extent of the front end of these listings, I think that's sort of a little background of where we are, and that's the limit on what the city of Eugene has done to support or oppose this listing. We're just trying to let this go on its merits. On the back end, when there is a listing, cities do have an interest in seeing historic areas preserved and the historic character of neighborhoods maintained. Right now, one of the reasons why people tend to visit other communities is historic tourism. It's one of the biggest burgeoning markets right now in the convention visitor industry. So we certainly have a stake there in trying to do a good job in enforcing and protecting the historic character of neighborhoods. Our policy is fairly soft. It is not a real explicit ordinance. We basically have very simple language. I'm sorry I don't have a copy of it with me today, but it basically is a simple statement that that we should go forward and try to preserve the historic character of neighborhoods. It's a soft policy. So I think I'll go ahead and stop there and see if there's any questions from members of the committee. I'll see if I can answer them.
Any questions? Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, so how far along in the process is this? That is, I understand boundaries have been determined. I can see that. As far as the nomination process, how far down the line have you gone? Or maybe not necessarily you, but do you know how far down the line we've gone?
Well, I think I might, if there's a representative from the SUNA group that might be able to better answer exactly the status of that question, I might go ahead and punt that to them. I think I have an acknowledgement they can answer that question when we get there. My understanding is we're getting close to a final stage, and that was one of the reasons why Mayor Piercy was contacted.
Chair Gerard, members of the committee, my name is Al Cooper. I'm not representing SUNA, but I have been involved as a resident of this proposed historic district. As to the question about the status, a little background, historic districts can be created, they can be nominated by any individual or group. The first thing you have to do is have a professional study by historic preservation experts that evaluates the merits, the substantive merits, the quality of the area. That was done in our case several years ago, actually. Those studies or reviews then get reviewed by local government, and Jason, the city actually did have a review of this by the Historic Resources Committee. It passed with flying colors. It was from that point they go up to SHPO, to the State Advisory Committee on Historic Preservation. This nomination passed with flying colors there also, and it was deemed a model nomination. That may explain Mr. Johnson's comment about why not many of these are turned down at the federal level. That's because they go through quite a bit of scrutiny at the local level. The process has a majority rule provision that districts can be killed by letters of remonstrance from 51% or more of the owners of property within the area. That's what's been going on in the last year or two. There's some technical legalistic reasons about who counts as an owner and all that we've had to work through. We've done that meticulously, following advice from the state attorney general on how to do that. And we're at the stage now where that work has been completed and the nomination has been returned to SHPO. The very next thing they will do, James Hammack, Deputy Historic Preservation Officer, can confirm this. The next thing they will do is provide additional public notice to owners in the area. That will allow yet one more opportunity for people to submit letters of opposition. So that's the status of it. I had one other thing I wanted to say to you. As Chair Gerard correctly noticed, this is a gut and stuff measure. It hasn't been well publicized. In fact, last night I looked at the statute's affected section in the legislative tracking system, and it didn't show up there. And we'd like to request that you not move this forward today, that you give a little more notice and have a hearing. We could have a lot more useful testimony for you, I think, if we had just a day or two more to prepare. In summary, I guess, though, our overarching feeling is that this is basically the idea for this law came from people who have been unable to achieve the majority to kill the district at the local level. It does not have a statewide constituency, and it has the potential for statewide harm. We think that regulations, reasonable regulations, are a major tool for historic preservation. And one last anecdote, if I may have another minute. The way the system works in Eugene for our existing historic districts, and we've had them for 23 years or so, if you're doing a significant alteration of a structure within a district, you have to apply for a building permit. That permit is then reviewed by the planning director for compliance with the standards for maintaining the historical integrity to the extent possible. If a decision is rendered by the planning director that is unpopular, that can be appealed to the Historic Resources Committee, which operates kind of like a planning commission. They're a lay group, and they can provide relief to either the owner or someone else in the neighborhood that has standing to appeal. In the 23 years we've had districts, there has not been a single appeal of a single-family remodeling. I think that tells us that the city hasn't been running amok and cramming unpopular ideas down people's throats. Thank you very much. And I'll be here if there are questions or
any questions of Mr. Cooper at this point. Representative Wright, is there a deadline for people to opt out? That's what I need to know. The current
to object to the nomination, you mean?
Yes.
I don't have the exact figure. I think it goes something like this, that SHPO will be sending a notice to people and also publishing notice in a newspaper. There is a comment period, and I believe it's 45 days, is that? I'm not sure. There's a fairly extensive comment period in which people can submit letters of opposition or support, for that matter. Did that address your question, or?
I think it does. I mean, there's still time for people to opt out.
It's your use of the phrase opt out that's confusing me a little bit. There's time for them to object to the formation of the district.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative.
Jason, I just want to make sure. What is the city's position on this bill? Is it neutral?
I believe we think that we're opposed to the bill as a separate issue from the South University neighborhood. It doesn't seem to be a good policy statewide. If there's a way to address some of these problems as far as contentious formations, we'd rather see that addressed at face value rather than an approach that kind of turns the whole process on its head and undermines the integrity of these districts statewide. If I can take that on face value, I think we'd love to be part of a conversation about that.
Okay. Any further questions from either of these two? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will this deny expansion to the university and the areas around it?
No, it will not. Right now, land use in general in Eugene, as elsewhere, is governed by the comprehensive plan, which has to comply with statewide planning goals, and we have any number of policies under the general rubric of growth management. But I've personally talked to the campus planner and talked to other people. they really like to have neighborhoods that are thriving and healthy, and we have another neighborhood in Eugene, and I shouldn't be too personal about it, where over the years it has shifted from a residential neighborhood with fine homes to an area which in the 1990 and the 2000 census had almost 99% rented occupancy. Our district is at 50% now, and it's working very well. And it's not so much that the university would build dormitories in the area, but there might be a private sector response to convert homes to student housing. And we think that having this district would provide a reasonable measure that whatever does happen blends in. And that's from my personal conversation with Campus Planner, that's the university's position. They have the biggest collection of historic buildings in Eugene is on the campus. So according to him, they're quite comfortable with historic districts.
I think from the responses that I've been getting, email, that was one of the concerns that many people had.
Thank you for your interest.
Any further questions?
Thank you, gentlemen.
Jason Hamrick with SHPO is here. I noticed that Mayor Piercy had written you the letter, so I assume, Mr. Hamrick, that you have an awful lot to do for us.
Mr. Chairman, James Hamrick. I am assistant director at Parks and Recreation and department in charge of the Heritage Conservation. I'm also in one of the divisions in my shop is the State Historic Preservation Officer, State Historic Preservation Office. And yes, Representative Gillard, I have been pretty deeply involved in this whole Eugene situation. And it is our office who processes serves as sort of the middleman for the federal process. We have a governor-appointed committee who reviews National Register nominations and then makes recommendations as to whether they should move forward. And then I'm the person that essentially signs the paperwork and sends it to Washington. And in response to Mr. Chairman, if I might, Representative Ackerman's question, the National Register takes letters of objection or to National Register nominations up until the moment that they the commenting period's over, and so once this nomination is sent back to Washington, people can still send objections to Washington directly up until the end of the 45-day review period. Mr. Chairman, just I didn't really expect to testify, but I just want to sort of make a couple of comments, if I might. I don't have anything prepared. I have been in the preservation business for a pretty long time, and I think I'm one of the few people in this room that's actually in heavily involved in the 1995 legislation that created the honor consent provisions. And I just want to there was a great deal of discussion about historic preservation policy, and those discussions were bipartisan. Oregonians in Action was heavily involved with this particular issue. Larry George and I spent a lot of time together, and we spent a lot of time in legislative council dealing with this issue. And I think the point I want to sort of make is that this was a policy that was enacted in a bipartisan way, and included, I really would like to point out, that when the rules were written for this statute, which in effect said that local jurisdictions had to protect National Register properties through some sort of ordinance provisions, that was also something that was done in a bipartisan manner with the Oregonians in Action at the table. So there was a general understanding of, essentially preservation, as far as we were concerned, took sort of a hit in 1995. But there was, I think everybody left the table thinking that everybody was more or less sort of content and that we could all move on. I think the legislative intent in 1995 was not really to end the entire preservation land use situation as was reflected in Bill 5. Essentially was to modify it. Subsequently, local jurisdictions still had historic preservation policies and programs and their comprehensive plans. They did not abandon historic preservation as a policy matter, and many, many local governments continue to have very thriving historic preservation programs.
Mr. Hammer, it would appear to me that the legislation was intended to give a local property owner an opt-out. In other words, an opportunity to get out, to not be a part of it. Don't you agree?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of the protection mechanisms?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that that was the legislative intent. I believe that the legislative intent relating to the protection of the resources that were on the National Register continued and was reflected in the administrative rules. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mendy is here, Bob Mendy is here, and he was present, I know, during that rulemaking, and perhaps he might want to comment on that.
Bob, would you like to come up with Mr. Hammer? Can't sit back there on the back row and not go unnoticed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Bob Rindy. I think what James is referring to, and I was peripherally involved at the time this happened, was that the opt-out provision was with regard to designation of a historic resource, except with regard to those that are in the federal districts. I wasn't present at the discussions or in the legislature, so I don't know all the history of why it was a split in that manner, but that's at least my understanding.
Any questions? And I interrupted you, Mr. Hammack. I apologize for that. Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, I don't really have much more to say. I know there are other people that want to speak. I just basically wanted to just, and this point has been made before, if this is a problem, if the legislature wishes to review this policy again, I think that the local jurisdictions who actually support historic preservation and think that it's a good deal, that there should be a considerably larger amount of statewide public discussion on this matter, because it does, the bill, the dash C's even, as they're written, would in fact basically have a, in our view, our reading, a pretty significant impact on historic preservation in the state.
So I'm still trying to get my hand around what the real issue is. The issue really is district versus the personal property rights. I mean, that's basically what this comes down to. That you're giving the federal district designation the trump card over personal property rights.
Mr. Chairman, what I think is that issue here is, frankly, is how people like to deal with their communities and how, what their communities are, and I think it's different in every single community. The National Register designation, we have over 75 historic districts, and we have historic districts that have been listed, have been in favor. We've had no objections whatsoever. It's been a sort of a kumbaya kind of thing from the get-go. In my mind, it is because the if you are living in a historic district and subject to a local government process that in most of the times is not prescriptive, but mitigative or even, not prescriptive, then in essence, you're just going through a process. And when the process is ended, then you're finished. In our view, the ordinance in the city of Eugene, where this is all sort of blossomed, is one of the weakest in the state. I'm not quite sure what everyone is afraid of there. And so in my mind, if it is, it's really, it's in the same way that all politics is local, so is historic preservation. Resource assist people in trying to do preservation in the way that they want to do it, and it's not the same in every jurisdiction. And I'm not quite sure that answers your question.
What do you do with people who don't want to be?
In terms of federal designation?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, the federal laws were basically set up to allow for this majority object before or ordinances would, properties would not move forward for registered designation. I think that consequence and based upon the way state land use laws and rules are written, local jurisdiction is supposed to basically place all the contributing properties, at least in those districts, under some sort of process-based ordinance. And we have basically ordinances like that in most every single jurisdiction in the state.
See, that's what Measure 37 did, and there's been a couple of polls out, one just released last week, that shows that people of Oregon want personal property rights restricted more than the good of the community. And I think that's exactly part of the case that we're dealing with in this particular, with this particular bill.
And, Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, I'm not an subject matter expert on that. Perhaps Mr. Andy is, but I think
he really appreciated you saying that.
Bob, Joe, I'm struggling as hard as many other people in my department to understand the measure, and it is a shifting landscape. I do think there's a question as to whether or not Measure 37 would apply. I presume there would be some argument that if the district was created tomorrow and regulations were applied to the entire district, including some properties for people that didn't appreciate those things. Okay. They could opt out under 37. I don't know for sure because there's a provision.
It seems to me, Bob, you're doing exactly what Measure 37 stopped. You're taking away the rights of the local property owner to do with their land what they want to. Only in this case, they're fighting the imposition of having a designation that they don't want. And it seems to me to be the same issue as Measure 37. You're trying to tell somebody to do something with their land they don't want to do.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that we are.
I apologize for that.
But I do think that it's certainly reasonable to look at Measure 37 as something that allows land use planning to go forward. The assumption is that people that want to opt out of new land use regulations may do so, and possibly including here. I think there's some question because of the federal overlay. I don't think that's easy to answer. But assuming Measure 37 applies, this district could go forward, individuals could opt out, and I think that was the intent of Measure 37.
If this bill were passed, Bob, in your opinion, what would be the effect in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, I didn't see these amendments till just today, and if they affect districts statewide, I think that it would mean that in some cases, individual property owners within districts, and I don't know how many there are statewide, we don't keep track of those, but my guess is that some number of property owners would no longer have to comply with local codes that typically regulate the way that they remodel their dwellings, what kind of materials they use and how that's done. They would not have to comply. I think that's what the effect of this would do. I haven't studied it.
So comply with something you never agreed to.
Mr. Chair, in the case of districts that were formed, districts have been formed for a very long time, and the problem with whether you agree to it or not is, of course, properties change hands. New owners may come in who really never had a chance. There may be owners that agreed to the district, but then as circumstances changed, wish they didn't. I don't generally deal with historic districts, so I'm not really familiar with all those situations.
And I apologize for putting you on the spot in this regard, Bob, because you haven't had time to look at this thing. I'm just seeing it's another application of Measure 37.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
Thank you. I think this is an important discussion we're having now, and the meaning of that survey was interesting because while it did say the state split 60-40 roughly on that issue of private property versus the common good, it also said that a large majority of people believe that land use planning was was good. I mean, both, there was that sort of paradoxical finding. And the real issue here is, I suppose, it's referred to as before, is the tyranny of the majority. But somewhere in our life, we need to have a representative democracy that says, okay, we'll all come together and make a decision as a group, and the majority will rule, and then we'll still have rights for the minority. I mean, it's an interesting dilemma we have in our society generally. But I'd like to ask a bit about the benefits of the designation of a historic district. We're not necessarily talking in this case about a single building as a historical building. That, I think, is a little different. That's one that the owners asked for at some point, I understand. But historical district, are there tax benefits? Are there real estate value benefits of being in a historic district?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kramlich, the incentive pieces vary according to local jurisdictions. Many local jurisdictions have incentive programs. I know that Eugene used to have several. The state has incentive programs. We have the nation's oldest special assessment for historic properties, and we also give out grants for construction for folks to rehabilitate their properties. There can be regulatory, in other words, non-monetary benefits through local jurisdictions. And so, in a sense, it is a jurisdiction-specific sort of thing.
Yes, Thomas? You know whether there's any, maybe we need to ask Mr. Levy on this one, whether there are any property value. I mean, moving from a ranchable neighborhood to a historic district may change the value of your property.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, I actually lived in a historic district myself for 15 years in Portland, and it was my experience, and we've honestly had to deal with this issue or question as to whether or not regulation of historic properties, in fact, lowers the value of your property. In the historic district that I lived in personally, once one property got rehabilitated, the next one did, et cetera, and it all sort of got on sort of a roll, and after about 15 years, I was pretty shocked at the book value of my property, because it had increased in value in ways that I would never have imagined when I first moved in there. So that may be different from depending on the district, but in my case, it was definitely so.
It's really, if I may comment, I have a historical district in my district, the so-called Alphabet District in Portland. And my impression is that the designation over time has reduced the property value. So you may have a Measure 37 issue on this one, but it's by far increased the property value, and that might be an interesting issue in whether there is a Measure 37 claim on this or not.
Mr. Show, I should add that why I vacillate on Measure 37 is that there is a clause in Measure 37 that exempts properties due to where a regulation is required by federal law. The reason that I'm unsure as to how that applies is I don't think it's mandatory that a district be designated, so that's not required by federal law. I do think, and I don't understand all the mechanism of this, that once you do designate one, there are some requirements that you have in ordinance of some sort. So that is a requirement. So I think it's an open question how Measure 37 might apply in a historic district. And I wonder whether that would even be resolved until it ultimately ends up with the courts. It could be that Mr. Johnson has a take on that. He's an attorney. I'm not. But I think it is clear that the voters in passing Measure 37 intended to exempt requirements from federal law.
So. Thank you, gentlemen.
My name is John.
Committee, I'm going to actually poll the committee at this point. We have several other people here who all wanted to speak on this bill. This is a work session, so I'm just curious as to proceeding. What do what the feeling of the committee is. Is this something that we should bring back for a full-blown public hearing? It seems to be a much deeper issue than originally looking over the dash twos, and it seems to be affecting far more things. Your opinion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Norman.
Given the comments that we've heard and the complexity of the amendments that people have not really had a chance, myself included, to digest and understand, if you're planning on moving forward, I think it would be appropriate for us to give ample opportunity for people to understand the amendments, digest them for their scope, whether it's specific to one city or statewide, and reconsider it at a public hearing where we can really look at this brand new bill, because it is, as you've said, a gotten stuff. It's a brand new bill.
Any other comments or opinions from the committee members?
This idea, I think this is not a single purpose bill for one district or one property, and I think the significance really is statewide. It would really be good to assess this. I think it would be very useful.
All right. I think the committee has heard enough at this point that we will come back. What's our schedule look like?
Mid-Friday?
Next week.
We're going to schedule a public hearing on April 27th. That's a week from Wednesday. I'll correct that to May 4th. And that will give all the parties a little more time to prepare a presentation for the committee. So we'll unless I hear any objection, Representative Ackerman?
I'm not objecting, but I think today's discussion was informative in terms of a broad overview, but I still think we need to narrow in on what are the consequences to a person opting in or opting out or refusing to consent with the legislation as drafted and then with the legislation as amended. I just don't get a feel as to what the consequences are for these property owners in various status.
Okay, hopefully the proponents and opponents of this bill will come back on May 4th and give us a more prepared, because I think there are some folks and committee members who have been taken a little off guard because we really have not had a public hearing on this bill. So I think that's the fair thing to do. And so, hearing no objection from the committee, we will close. We will reset this for May 4th, and we'll try to put it as the one of the first items on the agenda for that Wednesday. So we will close the work session on House Bill 3312.
May I ask a question before we finish? I'm wondering, since it's so vital to our neighborhood, and I'm a member of the South.
I'll tell you what, ma'am, we've just closed the work session on this bill, but if you'd like to come up to the microphone and identify yourself, I will allow you to speak to the committee if you'd like to.
I want to speak to Mr. Hammond.
Do that any time you'd like to. Committee will open a House bill, public hearing. House Bill 2963.
It's your show, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2963 is one which requires local governments to within boundaries provide for and to maintain both short and long-term supplies of land for industrial and commercial uses. I have been aware that Tom Gallagher has been working with LC to be able to provide a -1 amendments to the measure. At this time, I do not believe that it has been he's been successful in having that. We provided with you a proposal for content with dated April 21, 2005.
At this point, that's all that we have. We do not have the LC draft.
Okay. We have three people who would like to speak on this bill. I'll have Danielle, Colin.
Good afternoon, Chair Gerard.
You're the only person who have signed up against the bill, so voila, you get to go first.
Thank you for that honor. I'm the Public Affairs Director for the City of Wilsonville, and I'm here on behalf of our Mayor, Charlotte Lee Ann. She had other engagements today and could not be here, but wanted me to express her concern that this bill would come forward again without amendments that were seen by the committee or by interested parties within 24 hours ahead. So she could not rearrange her schedule to be here, but was hoping that it would not move forward and would have the opportunity to speak at another date.
So tell her we missed her.
I will. I'm happy to pass it on. And I would just leave with you a couple of thoughts. I know that I have looked at the content that's proposed for this bill. And just a couple of thoughts that you might have in your minds as you're reviewing them would be, who is this legislation for? What problem is it trying to solve? And who will benefit? It's very confusing. It has some requirements that seem to be challenging for local governments and certainly for the Economic and Community Development Department. So, be interested to see what those amendments finally are in the outcome, but looking at the draft, it seems a little onerous. I don't have any written testimony. We weren't really thinking that we'd be here like this today, but
we don't intend to move the bill today. So
I understand that. I appreciate that.
There will be a future opportunity to speak before we do that. Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Colin, Representative Miller.
I actually have a question of the chair, not of the witness.
Oh.
Can you refresh our memory as to who's working on this work group for this bill? Is there a work group, or is it an ad hoc?
I'll let the administrator.
I believe that on the work group that Bob Rindy, Tom Gallagher, that there were people from OECD. I have not been involved with it. I'm not sure how many other folks were on the group, but I think maybe Mr. Rindy might be able to elaborate.
Well, my specific question, Mr. Chair, if I might, is whether we have voices for local governments, particularly the League of Oregon cities there, who might be able to help sort out some of these issues in terms of burden imposed on local governments before it gets here, expecting us to sort them out. I'd much rather see them sorted out in the work group as fast as possible.
Bob, would you like to come up to address that question?
Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. There are representatives in the room, Linda Ludwig and Art Slack, who have been with the work group. The work group does, as was just reported, include OECD, and it includes some other people, Metro, and actually Tom Gallagher is the person who's organized those meetings, and I would defer to him to give you the whole list of names. There are some groups that have not been able to participate in the work group that's been discussed in the work group, the fact that there isn't, there aren't farming interests and some others there, but there is quite a large group of people. I don't think I could off the top of my head give you all the names.
Any questions of Mr. Rindy? Thank you, Bob. The last person to sign up is Kimberly Grigsby.
Chair Grodd, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kimberly Grigsby. I'm the regulatory liaison for Urban Economic and Community Development Department. I realize that we don't have a draft bill from Legislative Council, but I did just want to take this opportunity to thank Tom Gallagher and the other members of the work group who have been working so hard to work through this important issue. And OECD looks forward to seeing that draft from LC and providing you additional comments at that time.
Great, thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Committee, as you know, we have a the reason this bill was put up today is because we have a deadline to address House bills, which is coming up very rapidly on us. It's next Friday, a week from Friday. So those bills that we have given the opportunity to work on and bring them back, and the parties aren't ready, put the bill in jeopardy with this committee. Mr. Gallagher, I realize you're working with LC and that sometimes is a great dictator of time spent, but can you tell us how close you are, how far away you are, where this bill is at this point?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Gallagher for the Urban Developers Coalition. Your ammunition is well placed. It's taking a long, hard time, and we better be done this week or we might as well drop the bill. Or I'm going to ask the committee to make some decisions about how other people feel about it. I think there are different parties involved. With LCDC, the cities, or some parts of the cities, the counties, we're very close. The draft that's going to come out of Harrison will need 3 rent changes to satisfy those major players. There are other cities that don't like the bill in pieces or parts. And we are doing something here with OECDD, which I think should cause the bill to get sent to Ways and Means so that the Ways and Means Committee, who's looking at the OECDD budget, can figure out whether or not they want this to be one of the charges to OECDD. The issue there is, I think a couple of things, and take a second to say this. 4 years ago, we did 3557. Which said we don't have enough industrial land, but instead of everybody telling us that, oh yeah, you do, you got it here, you got it there, let's go study it. So we did a study. And the study came back, 3557 report, the legislature said yes, just like the real study out of Portland, you don't have the right parcels or the right size in the right places. So then we did 2011 last session, and we said let's take 25 sites and let's go out and see if we can't get 25 industrial sites on the board and ready to go within 6 months. A number of those sites, and I'm not exactly clear how many, but a number of those sites still are not ready for development. So even when we concentrate all of our resources on 25 sites, in two years, we can't get them online. There are good reasons for this. I'm not quarreling. It's not inefficiency or people not trying to take all the necessary actions. It's just very difficult in our situation. One of the biggest reasons is lack of infrastructure funding, and the second biggest reason is moving the urban growth boundaries if necessary if that land isn't there. And the third one is one that we haven't even put in this bill, and that's talking about industrial sanctuaries and conversion of brownfields inside of urban growth boundaries. So we couldn't even get to that issue. So we're still scratching around for the third session in a row now on the edges of being able to go out and compete for those high employment, high wage developments that have options to go to this state or to some other state or to some other community. Most of them want to be along the freeway in a large urban area close to an airport. 10 or 15, 20 minutes of traffic to the freeway can be enough to move somebody to another site in some other state. The suitability of a site, these sites are all the same, is in the eye of the planner or this community. They are identical. To the eye of the person who wants to use them, they're very different. One may have a different price. One may be 25 minutes from the freeway as opposed to 3 minutes from the freeway. One may have to go through a couple of congested intersections to get into a freight transportation route. So that developer says, I'm not going to put my money there. I've got other sites to choose from that aren't in the Portland metropolitan area. They're in Houston, they're in Denver, or somewhere else. They pay. As we come closer to making any of the hard decisions on this bill, everybody gets uncomfortable. And then we start making the language broader and less specific and so forth. And we're just down now, I think, to the point where if we'd gotten any less specific, it wouldn't be of much value. The one key factor that we've got in here that keeps me pressing on this is to go do these large sites on regional planning rather than city by city. to take what is in the rules now, the economic opportunity analysis, and do a special industrial trend analysis, not a backward-looking historical employment forecast, but a forward-looking. What's happening? What are the site selectors coming to the Oregon Economic Development Commission and telling them they're looking for? What did Margaret Kilpatrick's work group on industrial sites say were prime industrial sites? Those other sites that are there can be used, that are existent, can be used for a number of different uses. But if they're not the ones that these kind of developers, these large wage, high employment developers want, then they're just going to sit there anyway. The community can adjust to the fact that they may not come in the next 10 or 15 years. But we bring economic development into this to just to do that planning document. And then when they get done with that planning document and they say, Portland metro area, you need 15 or 20 sites with these site specifics, because that's what industry is looking for over the next 5 years. Then the cities will go out and they'll decide where these sites are, and they'll decide where they're divided among themselves. No sense in having too many of them. We only need 15 or 20. Let's pick where they should go. It's all up to the cities. Now, what if one jurisdiction says, we want, we'll move our urban growth boundary because we've got lots of sites that will match these specifics if you let us. And the other city says, we don't want them. We don't want any more industrial development, or we want it all to go here, and we'll take a chance that that's where they want to go. That's okay with me. But what I don't want is one city telling another city they can't do this. And it's, if you're going to leave it up to cities, then you've got to let the cities go both ways. You've got to let them say no, and you've got to let them say yes. And I think that's what's in this bill. And I think that's right now, in the last week or so, what we're running into is a bit of a drafting timeline. I really thought last week we would be here with an amendment in front of you. I left Harrison as late as 1 o'clock. You'll have a draft out this afternoon. I can distribute it to all of you and to the parties in the back. But you're still going to have to reach those decisions about using economic development, about doing regional planning for the large areas, and about letting the community, about finding and identifying the prime sites rather than the, this is what I think is prime, what the industry thinks is prime. So that's where we are, Mr. Chair. If we can't get this put together by, what's today, Monday? If we can't get it put together in the next 2 days, then I'll sit down with you and we'll see if you want to run a bill at all.
Sounds fair. Any questions of Mr. Gallagher? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2963. Committee, we are not going to, at this time, bring up the question of reconsideration of House Bill 2162. So, therefore, finding that we have completed our agenda, we will be adjourned until Wednesday.